Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Habakkuk chapter 2, which I will entitle The Righteous Shall Live by Faith. Woe to the Chaldeans. Habakkuk is that unknown prophet who prophesied sometime before the destruction of Judah in 586 by the Babylonians. We don't know when. He prophesied sometime before 586. We begin now in Habakkuk 2, verse 1. I will stand on my guard post and station myself on the rampart, and I will keep watch to see what he will speak to me and how I may reply when I am reproved. This is Habakkuk speaking. He says he's going to stand on his guard post and station himself on the rampart. Those are military terms, watchman, on the wall, at the guard post, at the rampart. The rampart is a defensive wall. Now, there's a question as to whether this is literal or not. Did he actually stand on the rampart of Jerusalem, or whether he's just speaking metaphorically? I suspect he's just speaking metaphorically. Why is he watching? He's watching to see what he, Yahweh, will speak to him. So a prophet's duty is not only to speak to the people, he also has to be very careful to hear from God. He wants to know how he may reply when Habakkuk is reproved. Reproved by whom? Option number one, reproved by God for presumptuously asking God how God could use a wicked nation like Babylon to punish Judah. If you recall in our last chapter, that's exactly what he did. He says, how in the world can you use Babylon to punish Israel since Israel is more righteous than Babylon? Judah is more righteous than Babylon. As sinful as Judah is, Babylon is worse. Well, in my humble opinion, Habakkuk is close enough to God to not worry about God reproving him for asking him. In my humble opinion, Habakkuk is close enough to God to not worry that God might be upset with him for asking a perfectly reasonable question. So I'm going to take it that Habakkuk is concerned about being reproved by the Jewish people, that they are going to object to hear that they are about to be exiled by Babylon, which is a natural response. No, 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 don't give us bad news, Mr. Prophet. Well, Habakkuk wants to be ready. He wants to know how to answer. So we go to verse 2. The Lord answered me, says Habakkuk. Write down this vision, clearly inscribe it on tablets so one may easily read it. Now, it's disputed as to what exactly Habakkuk recorded. Lee Smith, the commentator I'm using, one of the commentators I'm using for Habakkuk, said that the vision that was written down on tablets, stone tablets, was probably in chapter 1, verses 5 through 11, which contained the warning that the Babylonians were coming. Well, if that's so, then God just says, you tell them what I told you, and that's how you reply. You just tell them the truth. Now, this is somewhat unusual that Yahweh asked Habakkuk to write down his prophecy. Most prophets weren't told to record their prophecies for publication. Most were told to orally proclaim prophecies to the people. Now, Jeremiah was an exception once, but that was because he was denied access to the temple. We read in Jeremiah 36, 5 through 6, then Jeremiah commanded Baruch, I am restricted. I cannot enter the temple of the Lord. So you must go and read from the scroll, which you wrote at my dictation, the words of the Lord in the hearing of the people at the temple of the Lord on a day of fasting. You must also read them in the hearing of all the Judeans who are coming from their cities. So one time Jeremiah, constrained by necessity, wrote down his prophecy and asked Baruch, his secretary, to read out the prophecies. It was orally given, just not by Jeremiah. But usually the prophecies were oral. The prophet had to get up there and stand behind his words. There was a reason for this. Most people were illiterate back then, so they needed to hear. The Hebrew word for tablets used in verse 2 is never used to refer to small writing tablets, rather large tablets, so everyone could see and read, as Lee Smith says. Write it on big pieces of stone so one may easily read it. Now, that's the Holman Christian Study Bible translation, and it makes perfectly good sense, but unfortunately, the translations are not that easy or not that clear because there are a lot of other translations that don't quite read it that way. So let me read from the New American Standard Bible, Habakkuk 2:2. Then the Lord answered me and said, record the vision and inscribe it on tablets that the one who reads it may run. The one who reads it may run. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Adam Clark says that means that the one who reads the prophecy on the tablets will then run from the Chaldeans because he realizes they're coming. Another suggestion is that the words on the tablets would be so plain that one could read the tablet while one was running. John Gill suggests it means that the words were so plain that one could run his eyes through the text while reading. Lee Smith suggests that it means the reader might run and tell all his Israelite friends. Well, that's quite a divergence of opinion. Let me read you some other translations. Habakkuk 2:2, the American Standard Version. And Jehovah answered me and said, Jehovah is Yahweh, and said, write the vision and make it plain upon tablets, that he may run that readeth it. Whatever that means. Darby and the KJV translate the same way. Habakkuk 2:2 in the Bible in basic English. And the Lord gave me an answer and said, put the vision in writing and make it clear on stones, so that the reader may go quickly. Well, if that's basic English, I don't understand what that means. Habakkuk 2:2, God's Word translation. Then the Lord answered me, write the vision, make it clear on tablets, so that anyone can read it quickly. Now, that makes sense. That's like the Holman Christian Study Bible, which says, write it so that one may easily read it. The New American Bible reads this way, then the Lord answered me and said, write down the vision clearly upon the tablets, so that one can read it readily. Likewise, NAB is like the Holman Christian Study Bible. And in the Young's Literal Translation, we read, and Jehovah answereth me and saith, write a vision and explain on the tables, that he may run who is reading it, which makes no sense to me at all. I'm just going to take the opinion that Holman Christian Study Bible has, write down the vision, Habakkuk, so that everyone can easily read it. We go now to Habakkuk 2, verse 3. For the vision is yet for the appointed time. It testifies about the end and will not lie. Though it delays, wait for it, since it will certainly come and not be late. Now we see that the vision will delay from the time that Habakkuk gives it, and therefore, as I discussed in chapter 1, this tends to make people think that Habakkuk gave his prophecy a good while before 586 when the Babylonians actually came, because of this verse that says the prophecy is delayed. It'll certainly come, but it's going to take a while. And also we saw in the last chapter that the rise of Babylon was something that nobody could imagine. Well, after the rise of Nabopolassar in 625, people could imagine Babylon coming and getting the Israelites. So most probably the vision was given before 625, and I think that's reasonable. Now, from Habakkuk's point of view, if that's true, that would seem like a long time, from 625 to 586, but not from God's point of view. In God's point of view, the prophecy is hastening towards its fulfillment. The end is near. It testifies about the end of Jerusalem. The vision will not lie. It's going to happen. Habakkuk 2, verse 4. Habakkuk continues. Actually, the Lord continues as Habakkuk relates the words of the Lord. Behold, as for the proud one, his soul is not right within him, but the righteous will live by his faith. There's that famous quotation that's quoted all the time. Who is the proud one whose soul is not right within him? That's Babylon. Obviously, Babylon's soul was disordered, full of idolatry and other bad stuff. The righteous will live by his faith. Now, what Habakkuk meant was as that the righteous Jew who clung to Yahweh, who was stayed upon Yahweh, he's going to live through this horrible conflagration that's coming from the Babylonians. In fact, those who will live through the coming judgment are going to have faith. The righteous one will live by his faith, so he needs faith if he's going to make it through this mess. The righteous ones are those who are delivered from the Babylonians by faith. Now, Ellicott points out that we shouldn't translate this as he that is righteous by his faith shall live, to give it sort of a Pauline interpretation, because Habakkuk wasn't talking about right standing before God. He's not talking about justification by grace through faith so that one will live eternally in heaven with God. He's talking about being delivered from the Babylonians. Now, Paul meant that, of course, but not Habakkuk, as Ellicott said. I think that's reasonable. Here's what Ellicott says. Whatever force we assign to St. Paul's citation, here at least the words have no doctrinal significance. Their ethical importance is, however, undeniable. I think that's accurate. Paul meant, when he quotes that verse, the righteous shall live by faith, which I'm going to read to you in just a minute, he meant right standing before God. If you want right standing before God, which is righteousness, if you want that kind of alien righteousness that must be imputed to you from Jesus to you by his active and passive obedience, if you want that, you're going to have faith to receive it. You got to believe and repent. Now, I'll need to point out here, I don't think that Paul meant that if you want to be justified by faith, you believe, and then your justification is you get to be a member of the covenant community. You get to be a member of the covenant community. Justification means right standing before God, not being a member of the covenant community, as the New Perspective on Paul states. I've just been listening to a bunch of videos on that particular error, and I say it with a great deal of conviction. I don't care how nice a guy that N.T. Wright is, and I don't care how right he is about the inerrancy of Scripture and homosexuality is a sin, and that Jesus actually rose from the tomb. We'll give him kudos for that, but don't tell me that Paul didn't mean that justification meant right standing before God, because you take that away from the Bible, you might as well throw it out. What's the point of getting saved? That's an attack on the fundamental basis of the gospel, in my opinion. I really don't care how erudite N.T. Wright and E.P. Sanders and Dunn and all the other New Perspective on Paul people are. I really don't care. Now, the righteous one will live by faith. An internet commentator named Pett says that this is not only faith in the covenant of God, but it's also faithfulness to the covenant of God. In other words, not just confidence and trust in the covenant, but actually being faithful to the covenant. And I don't see why both cannot be included. Now let's look at the scriptures that are in existence that quote this verse in Habakkuk 2:4. Genesis 15:6 in the Great Covenant chapter. Then he, that's Abraham, believed in the Lord, and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. And of course, belief is the same thing as faith. Galatians 3:11, Paul says, now that no one is justified by the law before God is evident. For the righteous man shall live by faith. Romans 1:17, Paul says, for in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, but the righteous man shall live by faith. Quoting Habakkuk 2:4 again. Also the author of Hebrews, Hebrews 10, verse 38, but my righteous one shall live by faith. It's a very important scripture. Now, you might object and say, well, wait a minute, Paul didn't quote that in the same context. Habakkuk is talking about living through the Babylonian invasion, and Paul is talking about getting saved and having right standing before God. Paul can do that. He does that a lot. I've got no problem with that. I know a lot of people do, but it doesn't bother me. He just used what happened in the Old Testament. He took the example of living through the Babylonian invasion as an example of something you might want to do to live, and likewise you might want to live before God and not end up in hell. We go now to Habakkuk 2, verse 5. Moreover, wine betrays. An arrogant man is never at rest. He enlarges his appetite like Sheol, and like death he is never satisfied. He gathers all the nations to himself. He collects all the peoples for himself. Now, if you think about a drunk man, he's never at rest. He wants more. He wants more. He wants more booze. And if he's a glutton, he enlarges his appetite. He wants more food. He wants more food. He wants more food. His appetite is like Sheol. Sheol is a bottomless pit. His stomach becomes a bottomless pit. He wants more and more food for it. And like death, he is never satisfied. Death is never satisfied because death is always beckoning more and more people into Sheol. And so such a man, this drunkard and glutton, is compared to Babylon. Babylon is gathering all the nations to himself, collecting all the peoples for himself. In other words, people are being shoveled down the gut of Babylon just like food is being shoveled down the gut of this man. And just like Sheol is being stuffed full of death and dead people, Babylon is sucking people into its gut. Babylon is a voracious empire like a drunkard and a glutton. Babylon conquered Assyria, Israel, Egypt, Edom, Ammon, Syria, Tyre, Sidon. We go down to Habakkuk 2, verses 6 through 8. Won't all of these take up a taunt against him with mockery and riddles about him? They will say, woe to him who amasses what is not his. How much longer? And loads himself with goods taken in pledge. Won't your creditors suddenly arise and those who disturb you wake up? Then you will become spoil for them. Since you have plundered many nations, all the peoples who remain will plunder you because of human bloodshed and violence against lands, cities, and all who live in them. Verse 6, won't all of these take up a taunt against Babylon? These are the nations devoured by Babylon. They're going to be taunting Babylon with mockery and riddles. For example, who's the dumbest empire of all? What's the answer to that riddle? They will say, woe to him who amasses what is not him. They will say, woe to him who amasses what is not his. Now that's the first woe of the first. Now that's the first woe of the so-called five woes on Babylon. We'll see as we go through this chapter, there are five woes. Woe to him, that's Babylon, who amasses what is not his, because Babylon steals as she rapes other lands and countries. How much longer? And loads himself with goods taken in pledge. How much longer is Babylon going to do this? Loads himself with goods taken in pledge. In other words, we've conquered you, city or country. Babylon says, you owe us gold and silver. Please pay it every year, tribute. Oh, you're not paying your tribute? Well, your silver and gold is mortgaged, pledged, and we're coming after it, and you're going to pay us, and you're going to load us up with all the goods that you didn't pay. Verse 7, won't your creditors suddenly arise? Well, who's a creditor of Babylon? Most of the nations that are making up this mockery and riddles, those are debtors to Babylon, but now we have a creditor suddenly arise, a country that Babylon owes money to, and that would be Persia, who conquered Babylon in 539 B.C. And Persia suddenly arose, and those who disturb you, that's Persia disturbing Babylon, the NASB has collect from you. In other words, those who collect tribute from you, Babylon, those Persians who collect money from you and disturb you, who collect tribute from you, like a bill collector. Nobody likes to be disturbed by bill collectors, and so the Babylonians are going to have to pay when the bill collectors from Persia show up. Then you will become spoil for the Persians. Verse 8, since you have plundered many nations, all the peoples who remain will plunder you. And that's what the Persians did. They plundered Babylon. Now, some people complain about this and say, well, Persia never really plundered Babylon because Babylon wasn't ever destroyed. In 539, when the armies of Cyrus the Great took Babylon, the Persians and Medes overran the city, but they did not destroy the city. And so then people start saying, well, this refers to a revived Babylonia. Every time I hear the word revived, like revived Roman Empire, revived Babylonia, I have this creeping sense of nausea because it's such a punt. It's such a cop-out. No, that's not the way to handle this. Just because Babylon wasn't destroyed, that doesn't mean they weren't plundered. They had to give up gold and silver. In fact, the Medians and the Persians were eager to return to the rightful owners all the national possessions which were stolen by Babylon, because that would make the constituent elements of the new Persian Empire favorable toward Persia and least likely to revolt. These former underlings of Babylon will now show favor toward the Persians because the Persians got their money back and their idols back. Well, let's see how Persia gave Israel back the wealth that was plundered from the Israelites by the Babylonians. Cyrus the Great, the first Persian emperor, and he ruled from 559 to 530 B.C., he returned the temple implements that were used in the service of Yahweh in the temple in Jerusalem. We read that in Ezra 1, verses 4 through 7 and verse 11. Let every survivor, wherever he lives, this is from Cyrus's famous decree, every survivor be assisted by the men of that region with silver, gold, goods, and livestock, along with a freewill offering for the house of God in Jerusalem. So the family leaders of Judah and Benjamin, along with the priests and Levites, everyone God had motivated, prepared to go up and rebuild the Lord's house in Jerusalem. All their neighbors supported them with silver articles, gold, goods, livestock, and valuables, in addition to all that was given as a freewill offering. Now here's the important verse. Verse 7, King Cyrus also brought out the articles of the Lord's house that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had taken from Jerusalem and had placed in the house of his gods. The gold and silver articles totaled 5,400. Sheshbazzar brought all of them when the exiles went up from Babylon to Jerusalem. So, Babylon was plundered of its plunder. Babylon stole from Israel, and Persia stole it back from Babylon and gave it back to Israel. After Cyrus, with one Persian king in between, we get to Darius I, who ruled from 521 to 486. He granted a provision of money from the royal revenue to give to the Israelites. Ezra 6, 8 through 10 tells us this. Darius says, I hereby issue a decree concerning what you must do so that the elders of the Jews can rebuild the house of God. The cost is to be paid in full to these men out of the royal revenues from the taxes of the region west of the Euphrates River so that the work will not stop. And of course, that used to be in the Persian Empire, those provinces west of the Euphrates River. Whatever is needed, young bulls, rams, and lambs for burnt offerings to the God of heaven, or wheat, salt, wine, and oil, as requested by the priest in Jerusalem, let it be given to them every day without fail. so that they can offer sacrifices of pleasing aroma to the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and his sons. More money going to Israel from Persia. And of course, Persia got it from Babylon. Artaxerxes I. He's a few kings later too. He reigned from 465 to 424. He gave freely of his own silver and gold upon Ezra's return from Jerusalem. We read in Ezra 7, verses 14 through 16. You are sent by the king and his seven counselors to evaluate Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God, which is in your possession. You are also to bring the silver and gold the king and his counselors have willingly given to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem, and all the silver and gold you receive throughout the province of Babylon, together with the freewill offerings given by the people and the priests to the house of their God in Jerusalem. So Artaxerxes gave money, and of course money in his treasury. You know, a lot of it came from the Persians. Artaxerxes also granted all that Nehemiah needed to take back to Jerusalem. Artaxerxes did that by royal decree. We read in Nehemiah 2:8, Artaxerxes I did this. And let me have a letter written to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so that he will give me timber to rebuild the gates of the temple forest. And let me have a letter written to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so that he will give me timber to rebuild the gates. And let me have a letter written to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so that he will give me timber to rebuild the gates of the temple's fortress, the city wall, and the home where I will live. The king granted my request, for I was graciously strengthened by my God. So Israel was plundered, but Israel got a lot of money back. When I say Israel, I mean the southern two tribes of Israel, Judah. We go now to Habakkuk 2, verses 9 through 11. Woe to him who dishonestly makes wealth for his house to place his nest on high to escape from the reach of disaster. You have planned shame for your house by wiping out many peoples and sinning against your own self. For the stones will cry out from the wall, and the rafters will answer them from the woodwork. Now this woe is the second of the five woes on Babylon mentioned in this chapter. A man is mentioned who is a crook, makes a bunch of money crookedly, builds his house, but he puts his house way up on a high mountain to escape the reach of disaster. In other words, perhaps people will be upset with this man because he's a crook. Maybe he's like a mafia boss who has to have bulletproof glass put in all his windows. And this man is planned shame for his house by wiping out many peoples and sinning against his own self. Now the metaphor switches to Babylon. Babylon has built its house, metaphorically speaking, by wiping out many peoples. That's genocide, folks. Killing a bunch of people. Sinning against their own self. In other words, doing things that's going to hurt themselves. In verse 11, the things that hurt themselves are this. The stones will cry out from the wall, and the rafters will answer them from the woodwork. So going back to the metaphor of a house, the stones of the house will cry out from the wall, the rafters at the roof of the house, the ceiling of the house will answer, and they'll say, you're guilty. They will testify to Babylon's destruction. They're going to be crying out because they're going to be torn down and thrown into the rubbish pile. We now move to Habakkuk 2, verses 12 through 14. Yahweh continues, woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and founds a town with injustice. Is it not from the Lord of hosts that the peoples labor only to fuel the fire and countries exhaust themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord's glory as the waters cover the sea. Now verse 12 is the third of the five woes. It begins the third of the five woes. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed. Of course, that's Babylon. Building its empire with bloodshed. City is used as a symbol of an empire. The bloodshed, of course, refers to Babylon's conquest of nations. There's a little bit of repetition in verse 12. Builds a city with bloodshed and then founds a town with injustice. Same idea. Verse 13, is it not from the Lord of hosts that the peoples labor? The peoples, of course, are the Babylonians. Only to fuel the fire. So all the work the Babylonians, the peoples, did and established their cities would be brought to naught because all of those cities that they built will furnish the fuel that will create a fire that will burn up Babylon. And so Babylon is said to exhaust itself for nothing. In verse 14, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord's glory. Of course, that's referring to the knowledge that the Babylonians have gone down by the almighty hand of God, and that knowledge of Yahweh's sovereignty will be like the waters that cover the sea. In other words, as vast as the oceans. Waters covering the sea sounds a little bit repetitive. Water on top of the sea. But that's the idea, is that the knowledge of the Lord's glory will be as vast as the expanse of the oceans. Now, Habakkuk didn't expect his prophecy to be fulfilled in the way it was. Yes, the world knew about the destruction of Babylon by the Lord through his agent, the Persians. But eventually, this was fulfilled by the gospel. And here's how it worked. Persia destroyed Babylon. The Jewish exiles in Babylon returned and rebuilt Jerusalem. They refound the state of Israel. Jesus is born in Jerusalem, and now look, we have believers all over the world, and the knowledge of the Lord's glory is spreading all over the world, even as you and I sit here. There's a similar verse in Isaiah 11, verse 9. They will not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. We go now to Habakkuk chapter 2, verses 15 through 18. Yahweh continues, Woe to him who gives his neighbors drink, pouring out your wrath and even making them drunk, in order to look at their nakedness. You will be filled with disgrace instead of glory. You also drink and expose your uncircumcision. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter disgrace will cover your glory. For your violence against Lebanon will overwhelm you. The destruction of animals will terrify you because of your human bloodshed and violence against lands, cities, and all who live in them. What use is a carved idol after its craftsman carves it? It is only a cast image, a teacher of lies. For the one who crafts its shape trusts in it and makes idols that cannot speak. Now in verse 15, Yahweh says once again, Woe! This is the fourth of the five woes of this chapter against Babylon. Babylon is said to be like a neighbor that gives a neighbor alcoholic beverage, making them drunk in order to pour out the neighbor's wrath on the victim, in order to look at their nakedness. Now, that's a general metaphor for shame. It sounds like date rape, actually. It'd be a good verse to use against date rape, if you take it out of context, but nakedness is a general metaphor in the scripture for shame. So Babylon will make its neighbors drunk to make them ashamed as they go around trying to conquer the world, which they did. Now here's some biblical examples of nations being naked and ashamed after they were destroyed. Isaiah 47:3, this is referring to Babylon, your nakedness will be uncovered. Your shame also will be exposed. I will take vengeance and will not spare a man. Lamentations 1:8, again, this is talking about Babylon. This verse is talking about Jerusalem, not Babylon. Jerusalem sinned greatly. Therefore, she has become an unclean thing. All who honored her despise her because they have seen her nakedness. Even she herself groans and turns away. Nahum 3, verse 5. Behold, I'm against you, referring to Nineveh, declares the Lord of hosts, and I will lift up your skirts over your face and show to the nations your nakedness and to the kingdoms your disgrace. Now, is there anything sexual in this imagery? Lee Smith, the online commentator I discovered, he says this refers to removing clothes for sex. So Babylon is removing its neighbor's clothes while preparing to rape them. Now, that is an unusual interpretation. I don't know if he's right or not, but it does sound like it. The reason a neighbor would make his neighbor drunk in order to pour out his wrath upon him is because somebody that's drunk has lost their senses. They can't defend themselves. And verse 16, in response to that, you, Babylon, are going to be filled with disgrace instead of glory. Your glory was great amongst the nations. You held sway over the whole ancient Near East. But you are going to drink. You made your neighbors drunk so you could take advantage of them. Now you're going to get drunk and you're going to be weak. And you're going to stagger around, and you're going to expose your uncircumcision. Uncircumcision means you're not in the covenant. You're a pagan. You're a heathen. The cup in the Lord's right hand, that's the cup of God's wrath, will come around to you. And, of course, the implication is Babylon's going to drink the cup of God's wrath. Utter disgrace will cover your glory, and that's exactly what happened when the Persians got them and took them over. Verse 17, for your violence against Lebanon will overwhelm you. Now, Babylon literally destroyed Lebanon after the Battle of Carchemish, which was in 605 when the Babylonians wiped out the remnants of Assyria and also the Egyptians. And then they went on further from Carchemish, which is on the Euphrates River in Syria. They continued going west and they destroyed Lebanon, Phoenicia. But that violence is going to come back on Babylon's head. It's going to overwhelm Babylon. The destruction of animals will terrify you because of your human bloodshed and violence against land, cities, and all who live in them. In other words, all your livestock is going to get wiped out. And of course, back then, livestock was a source of wealth. Verse 18, Yahweh says, "What use is a carved idol after its craftsman carves it?" Rhetorical question. The answer is none. No use at all. It is only a cast image. A cast image is an image that's made out of a metallic mold in which molten metal, not a metallic mold, I should say a mold of wood and clay maybe, and the molten metal is poured into the mold, and then after the metal dries on the inside, the outside is knocked off, and then one has an idol. And this idol is a teacher of lies. It can't speak, but it does teach you to worship a god who is not God. For the one who crafts its shape, trusts in it, and makes idols that cannot speak. This is a common put-down of idolaters. You're making idols, you say they're gods, they can't even talk. What kind of a god is it that can't talk? We go now to Habakkuk 2, verses 19 through 20, and we will finish this chapter. Yahweh continues, "Woe to him who says to wood, 'Wake up,' or to mute stone, 'Come alive.' Can it teach? Look, it may be plated with gold and silver, yet there is no breath in it at all. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let everyone on earth be silent in his presence." Verse 19, "Woe to him who says to wood," that's the fifth of the five woes on Babylon. Now, we'll bring in an opinion of Lee Smith. He says that all five woes could refer to Judah as well as to Babylon, because Judah was evil too, just like Babylon was. But I don't think so. This is a prophecy against Babylon. Once again, the idols are mocked. They can't speak. They can't live. Come alive, you dead idol. Well, it can't teach either, because it can't speak and it's dead. It doesn't have any breath in it, despite all the fancy gold and silver that's plated on the outside of it. In contrast to that stupidity, in verse 20, Yahweh says, "But the Lord is in his holy temple." Now, that could either be heaven or it could be the temple in Jerusalem. I'm not sure which it is. But wherever he is, it causes everyone on earth to be silent in his presence, in awe of his majesty. And on that happy note, we have finished Habakkuk chapter 2. We're now prepared to move in our next audio to chapter 3 of Habakkuk, which I will entitle Habakkuk Praise and Rejoices. So we're going to end up the book on a happy note. I hope you stay with me for Habakkuk chapter 3, and I hope you enjoy this audio.